Wolf Smoke has been an Indigenous activist for over 20 years. Having been involved in Indigenous self-determination movements for decades in Quebec, Saskatchewan, and South Dakota, Wolf Smoke has been under constant harassment from Immigration Canada as well as the RCMP for declaring himself, quote, pre-Canadian. Smoke, being an Indigenous person who both has been active in organizing resistance movements within various Indigenous communities throughout North America and who refuses to accept the authority of either the Canadian or American governments, has become a state target. Having been fired from his job as a grade 9 science school teacher at a high school in Regina, Saskatchewan, for his pro-Indigenous views having been expressed within the classroom environment, he has since been at battle with both the RCMP and Immigration Canada over his status as a quote citizen and his views about nation states and the illegitimacy of borders. CKUT Radio spoke with Wolf Smoke about the harassment and abuses which he has been receiving from Immigration Canada and the RCMP.
Basically, what happened is that I was in South Dakota. I came up here almost 2 years ago. Now, I had lived in Regina before, worked here before. I came back here almost 2 years ago for a visit. When I was here, I was encouraged to apply for a job within Student Support Services at Scott Collegiate, which is a predominantly Indian school, inner city school here in Regina. None of the staff members were Indian, but the year that I was working there, all of the students except for three or four were Native kids. And I got tired. I applied. I didn't want to stay here. I don't really like cold weather. I don't like living in a city. I miss my horses. And, in Canada, people talk funny. So I didn't want to stay, but I applied for the job, and they wanted me to start working right away. I started working as teacher associate in Student Support Services, and then due to my science background, the conservation biology program through Oglala Lakota College, they asked me to co-teach grade 9 science. In reality, I came up with all of the material, I delivered all the material, I did everything, but with the school board and that, there's certain regulations, and so they couldn't say I was teaching because I wasn't a certified teacher. So technically, I guess you'd say I was co-teaching grade 9 science. At the end of May, the principal said that because what they call National Aboriginal Day up here was on June 21st and our last day of school is June 20th, that she wanted to have the 20 days in June would all be National Aboriginal Day for that school. And I did a number of things. Already on a daily basis, I incorporated the Lakota perspective or the Indigenous perspective in my science class. But on top of that, I did things like running Native America calling programs on the computer in the library at lunch hour. I spoke to art class on Native art, and I took one of my paintings and some carvings in. I did a number of things, but one thing that I did was I brought in from the library downtown, I brought in a Robert Redford documentary called Incident at Oglala. And I played that. Basically, that's a documentary about how two white FBI agents committed suicide with the help of Indian people in the 1970s on Pine Ridge Reservation. And a couple of days after I played that, two immigration agents and a cop came in a bad mood or yelling. One of them was swearing. They demanded I quit my job. I refused. They marched into the principal's office, demanded that she fire me. She refused. So then the board office was contacted, and they had no choice but to let me go the day before the last day of school. And then in there they said that they were going to set up an immigration inquiry within 2 weeks where I would have to prove my right to work in Canada. And they said, in order to do that, what you have to do is you have to provide us with a birth certificate. And they already knew, because I'd been contacted by HRDC, or Human Resources Development Canada 2 months prior to that about the social insurance number. We had a lengthy interview with them. I explained why, because of the laws with Ontario Vital Statistics, why I was unable to get a birth certificate, which is what's required for a social insurance number. They asked me how I was able to get an American Social Security number, and I explained to them how I got that. At that point in time, HRDC led me to believe that they were going to find a way to get a social insurance number for me. But then when the political issue came up, then things were different. In that argument, I told them that, well, no, instead, what you need to do is when we have this hearing, you prove to me that you have any right to be in a work in Canada or that you have any authority over me. And then I told them, you look at the color of my skin and you look at the color of your skin and you tell me who has a right to be in what you call Canada. That's when the profanity started. And then they got me into court, provincial court, 1 week later. You know, ordinarily, anywhere I've been, it takes months to get your first appearance in court. It took 7 days for me. And the thing that was so unique about it is that this all came down on June 19th. 7 days later, I was in court my first time on June 26th. And June 26th is the anniversary of the shootout at Oglala. And from there were just a number of things that, you could be as right-wing and as pro-Canada, you know, as is possible. And looking at everything that has happened this past 14 months or whatever, there's no way that you could fail to realize that this attack on me is nothing but political.
We spoke a little bit about this earlier, but this is ongoing colonialism. Could you speak about that in the context of your case, but also in the broader struggle?
Okay, I think that the clearest example or the most well-known example would be if you go back 80 years into the mid-1920s with the case of Descahe, or Levi General. This is someone who was a Cuga chief, a traditional chief, not a puppet, you know, IRA government guy, but a real Indian leader from the Six Nations community near Brantford, Ontario, who, because Canada refused to give him a passport to travel to Geneva to tell the world about the colonialism going on here, the genocide that Canada is enacting against us. The Six Nations Haudenosaunee government created a passport, as far as I know, the first time ever that an Indigenous government created a passport for an Indigenous nationalist. Descahe had traveled to Geneva on a Six Nations passport. When he returned, he came into New York, and when he attempted to cross this illegal border, go back to his home and his farm in Six Nations, Canadian immigration stopped him, wouldn't allow him to cross over, and then he ended up spending out the rest of his days on the Tuscarora Reservation in New York State at a friend's house, and then he died there. And, this is a non-violent man. There's no, the guy didn't drink. He had a family. There's absolutely nothing bad that you can say about his life or his past. And because he's so well known and because his situation is so clear, there's no way to say that this is not an act of genocide against him. And there's other people. There's a guy, I can never remember how to say his name, I call him GK, but he lives in New Brunswick at Burnt Church. He's been dealing with immigration for more than 15 years. On my Indigenous Awakening website, I have a link to a page about him. There's a guy, his last name is Watt, from British Columbia, who's going through the same thing, again, fighting with Canada immigration. And the thing is that these other people don't make it into the media. With me, my timing was just right. They needed someone to counter the tightening up of the border story. And then they have an Indian guy who's got a family, who's a science teacher, so I was a perfect counter. You know, to that, and the media used me, you know, when they needed me at that time. But what it comes down to is that Canada violated the Discahes rights 80 years ago, and they used an illegal immigration policy to go against everything from the Royal Proclamation to the Treaty of Ghent to Universal Declaration of Human Rights. All of these things they violated in their treatment of the Discahe. It's been almost a century since that time. They have neither acknowledged what they did to Levi General, and also that they've yet to change their policies. And immigration isn't like what they call a court of law or their, you know, farcical justice system, where at least in there are timelines and checks and balances. With immigration, they can do anything. When they arrested me, they put me in an RCMP barracks because some of the jailers in the RCMP barracks were sympathetic to me. Without reason and without telling anybody, they suddenly came to the jail there, transferred me to another jail. The other jail that they took me to, the Regina Correctional Center, there were also jailers there who were sympathetic to me. And I told the jailers, look, no one knows that I've been... no one knows that I've been moved to a different jail, and I need to make a phone call. And the guy said, well, our orders state that you're supposed to be going into maximum security and that you're under lockdown and that you're supposed to have no contact with anybody. And he said, but it's going to take me a couple of minutes to take care of this paperwork, and there's a phone right there. And he turned his back and stepped into an office, and I had, you know, picked up the phone and I got the word out. But there's over 1,000 other people, probably mostly Muslims, I don't know, you know, different people that immigration in Canada and other countries have picked up, and they put them in jails, and they didn't luck out like I did. Nobody, their family has no idea where they are. They're not being charged with anything. And so you can't consider the immigration department as being a just system. I mean, they're a bunch of thugs. They don't answer to anybody. They can do anything they want. They've lied to the media about me. They lied to United States Customs. There's been times when they've lied to the media, and I've taken documentation to prove them, you know, to tell CBC or CTV or Global, put your camera on this piece of paper, and this will clear up the lie that they told you guys before. I mean, that's perjury. The media won't pick it up. And any intelligent person, when you look at the way that immigration and the federal government has handled my case, the fact that they have made up names, they said that I was Charles Hornchips, and then I found out afterwards that the reason that they're using this Charles Chip story is because there's a guy same age as me from South Dakota who's a fugitive from the FBI. His brother's name is Charles Chips, and he uses that as an alias sometimes. When I said that on CBC Radio and explained that issue, they quit using that. Most everybody calls me Wolf, and I prefer that over Charlie. And so what they did is they say he uses a number of aliases like Charlie Wolf or Wolf Smoke or sometimes just Wolf. They took times that I had been picked up by the police as a kid, and everything that they could find, they moved up into just a few, like the past, I think, 3 years. And they said he was arrested this year for this thing. It wasn't true. They said that he was arrested in 1 year when I was living in Saskatchewan. They said I was arrested for something in the States. And, you know, I explained all this to the media. It's obvious that from the beginning, immigration has been lying to the media. They've tried to create problems. They've had a tap on my phone for over a year now. They've hacked in and destroyed my computer. They've been monitoring my emails, stopping certain emails, preventing people from viewing my newsletter or my website at different times. My best friend's phone, Stephen has a tap on it now because I phone him a lot, and sometimes I use his phone. So when you look at the way that immigration has handled my case, no intelligent person is going to believe anything at this point that they say. And they've even taken to harassing my children. And I was in B.C. Just over a month ago, and twice, once with the Vancouver City Police, once with the Hope RCMP, they came in, and for bogus reasons, they're harassing me, they're threatening my son. It was just the two of us were out there. I spoke at an environmental conference, and then I took my son, Pankeska, to a kung fu tournament in Burnaby. He'd been feeling a lot of stress from the political situation here, so I thought if I take him with me for a couple of weeks to B.C., you know, it'll help my son to feel better. But as it is, things got worse, you know, to the point that my son even confided in a friend of mine in Vancouver that he had considered suicide. He's just 8 years old. They picked me up. They said, we're going to detain your father. We're going to give you to social services. They keep this up for about an hour, and then suddenly, oh, well, I guess everything's all cleared up. Okay, you can go. I mean, it's just pure bullshit to attack an innocent child. You know, I realize that they have a lot at stake financially and politically with what I stand for and what I'm saying. So I expect them to attack me, but to be so cowardly to attack my children. I have six children here. They're all young. The youngest one is only 7 months old right now. And for the federal government to terrorize my children, to give my children nightmares, you know, these people are nothing but crooks and cowards.
Could you speak about the importance of people showing their solidarity with your struggle and Indigenous struggles for self-determination around the world and in Canada?
Well, for one thing, it's important to, I mean, you look at what evil people do. You know, just quickly to jump back to the Stronghold Table, there were ghost dancers there from Indigenous nations that, according to the history books, that the Lakota people were enemies with. So now when you see that they try to divide people like that, and you know that they're an evil people, you know, that this colony, then just that alone is enough to tell you that, okay, we need to come together because they're trying to divide us. And then if you look at how they have kept people separate, like, for instance, the Indigenous people from here and Indigenous people from what they consider Latin America, and they really play that card in relation to the United States and Mexico border, where you have Indigenous people or brown-skinned people who maybe are half Native and half Spanish, or maybe they're pure Native, or whatever fact. I mean, they have rights here. When they come across, they say, well, these people are illegal aliens, and so we need to unite within those groups. And all oppressed groups, because we're all facing the same type of attack. People of any people of color, people of religions who aren't Christian, or lesbian, gay people, anyone who's under attack by the colony in the Americas right now has to unite. Because if we unite, then we're that much stronger. And the louder voice that we have, the more likely that we're able to bring changes and to bring some level of humanity and maturity into this country. But as long as within our different groups that we stay separate, you know, then the oldest tool that they have is divide and conquer. And as long as we allow them to continue using that tool against us, then none of our groups will ever succeed. And basically, we all want the same thing. We want, you know, a healthy and a happy future for our people. And the only way that we can achieve that is if everybody comes together under a common mind and attacks this evil that is amongst us, that's hurting people and the land, and is keeping us separate.
One specific struggle which Wolf Smoke has been involved with is the current battle with the National Park Service of the United States at Stronghold Table Camp. Stronghold was the place where the Lakota, along with their allies, made a stand to protect themselves from the 7th Cavalry on December 29th of 1890, who had just murdered over 200 men, women, and children at a small hamlet that today is called Wounded Knee. This is the site which provided sanctuary for all the people to gather during the day-long battles with the European colonialists after the murders at Wounded Knee. For the past 3 weeks, Indigenous activists have been finding remains at Stronghold Table Camp in South Dakota, the remains of hundreds and hundreds of people, which paint a picture of an untold story of genocide. Those discovering their ancestors' remains at Stronghold Table Camp are attempting to keep people away from the site and are at constant battle with the United States Park Service, who want to cover up the newly found remains and take this land from the indigenous people of Stronghold Table Camp. We spoke to Charlie Smoke about this struggle.
And right now, in South Dakota at Stronghold, there is a struggle going on with the American Park Service. Could you speak about that?
All right. What happened is that in, I think it was about the late, I mean about the third week of June, the Tokala Kuche in, from Wounded Knee District on Pine Ridge Reservation went on to an area of land in the Badlands called Stronghold Table. I know that people won't be able to write this down, but I set up a small website for them recently. The URL there is http://stronghold.table.tripod.com/stronghold.table.camp/. But they can, it's at the bottom of my tripod website, which you can find by doing a Yahoo or Google search for Charlie Smoke or Indigenous Awakening. The reason that I put that out there is that there are a lot of new developments coming out, and tomorrow, you know, there might be something important that doesn't exist today, but as it comes, you know, I'll put it on that website there at Tripod. But what happened is that the history of that site, Stronghold Table, is given that name because 100 years ago, when our religion or our spirituality was outlawed, people who were involved in the ghost dance went to Stronghold to hide out so that they could practice their religion without being attacked by the Americans. And the geography of that area is unique because it's a large area, but the only way to get to it by land is through a real small, a real narrow corridor, which is easily, due to the terrain, it's easily defended. And so the United States was reluctant to go in there, even though they knew that there were people, you know, families camped there. And because of the importance and the sacredness of this site, Indian people afterwards and later generations didn't spend a whole lot of time there. No one set their homes up there. People didn't go there to picnic because it was, you know, such an important place. And recently, we found out that there are remains scattered throughout that area, and these are remains of adults mixed with children, human remains mixed with horse remains. And if you go there, it's immediately recognizable that what happened was there was a massacre on that site, and the bodies weren't buried. Instead, they were pushed over the edge of Stronghold Table. And now the National Park Service, specifically William Supernaw and Badlands National Park, are trying to cover up the evidence of this massacre. They have excavations in August and in September, and they're coordinating with Chadron State College and South Dakota State School of Mines and Technology with the National Park Service to go in and excavate bones. But they're saying that it's titanosaur and different dinosaur bones that they're after. But they've already taken at least two human remains, and there's been no public acknowledgement of that. They're in a violation of NEPA, and they're in violation of NAGPRA by going in and excavating human remains. But what they want to do, obviously, is to cover up the fact that there was a massacre there, which is more atrocious even than the Wounded Knee Massacre in 1890. And, of course, also it's a further attempt to take more land away from the Lakota people. And if you look on National Park Service maps, and I have a copy of one on the Stronghold Table Camp website at Tripod, and it shows in brackets beneath Stronghold, what they call Stronghold Unit or the South Unit of Badlands National Park, and it says on there, within Pine Ridge Reservation. But yet, the Oglala Sioux Tribe at Pine Ridge has stated that they want the land back, and that whole issue is much too complex to get into in this interview, but basically the people have said, you don't belong here, this is our land, we want it back. National Park Service is ignoring the traditional people, like the Tokala Warrior Society, and even the elected IRA government, the Pupper government, which is the Oglala Sioux Tribe.
Could you speak about why the National Park Service and overarching that state authorities would feel it is important to cover up this massacre and how that relates to ongoing colonialism?
They've been trying to cover up and downplay everything that they've done for 500 years. They tried to downplay the infamous Wounded Knee Massacre from 1890 by saying that, well, there was a deaf-mute Indian who refused to let go of his gun, and it accidentally discharged, was set off as chain reaction. Basically what it is that they surrounded a peaceful camp at Wounded Knee in 1890. They disarmed everybody. The people had been traveling for 2 weeks through a blizzard, and they got on hills with Gatling guns surrounding the Indian people, and after disarming them, opened up on them. And then they wanted to say, well, it wasn't really a massacre, it was a misunderstanding, things got out of hand. They don't want to admit to what they've done, because all the Indian people alive today are victims of all of these land grabs, victims of the residential school system, all these acts of genocide, and so every Indian alive today has a legal claim in international courts against the colonies throughout the Americas, and they have to set things up so that the Indian people that are here today don't realize what they really did to us. They control the history books, and that they have to separate, you know, what the residential schools was about. They have to separate us from the people in our communities who know the real history of the land. And then seeing as how that was entirely successful, when people like myself stand up and speak out against them, challenge their authority over our people on our land, or even the validity of their government, they have to silence those people. And then if you look at how the United Nations designates what constitutes a sovereign nation, some of the points that they come up with are having a language and a culture of your own and a land base. The United States and Canada doesn't have a legal land base because they're squatting on our land. There's areas of land that we allowed them to live, but it's not legally their land. The majority of the land that they're on, like for instance in British Columbia, they have absolutely no legal claim to. They don't have a culture of their own, because the culture they have now is really predominantly stolen from Indian cultures, with some semblance of European cultures still hanging on. And the languages that they have, like in Canada, French and English, are not unique to Canada. This is not Great Britain, it's not France. So they have no culture, they have no land base, they have no language, yet they call themselves a sovereign nation. In reality, there is no legal government of the United States or Canada.
You've been listening to an interview with Wolf Smoke, an Indigenous activist based in Regina, Saskatchewan, about his recent struggles with citizenship and Immigration Canada, over his rejection of the Canadian state, and efforts to highlight the years of injustice and colonialism which Canada is built on. For more information, check out www.charlie_smoke.tripod.com. Email charliesmoke@hotmail.com. This interview has been produced for Native Solidarity News by Stefan Christophe.